Well, thanks very much for coming, everybody, and welcome to the first panel of the 2009 Fries Talks program, which is organized by the Fries Foundation and the editors of Fries Magazine, Jennifer Higgy, Jörg Heiser, and Dan Fox. This panel will argue against three of the most common criticisms and truisms leveled at contemporary art. The first of these is that it's elitist, confusing, and irrelevant. The second, that it's peddled by unskilled charlatans conning the general public, and that poor us will be more inventive and radical because they're not corrupted by the market. So before we begin, I'll introduce our panel. Catherine Romberg, curator of the next Berlin Biennale in 2010. Adrian Searle, lead art critic of the Guardian newspaper. And Roger Hyons, artist and current contender for the Turner Prize. So I guess before we begin all of this, it seemed to me that this is a conversation couched in very British terms. And I was wondering, Adrian, if you could respond to that. These particular kind of difficulty, these particular platitudes, do these seem to be very couched in British culture to you?
I do get that feeling, yes. Certainly in European terms. I'm less familiar, really, with the general culture of America particularly. But when I read... art criticism, certainly in newspapers in the rest of Europe, it seems somehow less defensive in a way than sometimes one feels British art criticism is, certainly in the broader media. Because for a long time, one had to kind of explain to the readership and to one's editors why a video might be art what an installation was and so on. I mean, I think we've got over that now, certainly in the last 10 or so years. But there is a sort of level at which there is what seems to be an endemic and almost deep-rooted suspicion of art. Well, that modern art, it's all rubbish, isn't it? You know, typical... There was a time when every cab driver would say that if you happened to mention that you were going to the Fries Art Fair or something. But nowadays they don't. They say, "Well, I was in that Gagosian's the other day. Fucking great show, mate." but actually, it's not a class thing at all. But there, it does seem to me that there is, and I've had editors who've said, you know, "So what's the hook? Why is that any good? This conceptual art, what is it?" And I say, "Well, that's a movement from some years ago now." But the feeling always was that British culture was rather more literary than it was attuned to visual art. And the only artists people knew were people like Picasso, and the name would always come with a rider, which was pulling the wool over the public's eyes. That Picasso, laughing all the way to the bank, wasn't he? And so on. Picasso, David Hockney, who was like the only gay artist that people would kind of accept when he was younger and had blonde hair and a gold lamé jacket. But because he was a sort of personality in a sort of rather lovable way. At a time when he was openly gay, when it was illegal, you know, pretty much, and you could go to prison for being so. Or Henry Moore or something, you know, was also well known and much loved. But nowadays there are dozens of artists, and artists have become personalities, as we know, and the cover of Guardian's G2, predictably enough, had Tracy Emin and Grayson Perry on the cover. And you think, well, not only does British art have a suspicion of contemporary art, but it has an even bigger suspicion of foreign contemporary art. So you can have artists who do what are relatively difficult things. I say relatively, because I was going to mention Sam Taylor Wood, for example. But whose work, you know, it took a long time for people to recognise that video, for example, was perfectly acceptable art form. But because it's made by a perfectly acceptable artist, then that's okay. But if it's made by one of these foreign chappies, you know, and swarthy or possibly worse, then...
Can you think of a particular example of that?
Well, there are lots and lots of examples, aren't there? And I don't think it was race-based at all. I just think there is a sense in which one has to go the extra mile in order to not only defend artists from abroad, but to say that they're good. And I think this is it's a strange cultural phenomenon. I mean, obviously, at this second, names have just evaporated entirely from my brain, and as they tend to do. But take, for example, John Baldessari.
Mm.
Please, take John Baldessari. you know, who's, if you like, the grandfather, one of the grandfathers of conceptual art. Or no, he's sort of Duchamp's nephew, isn't he? He's the playful bad boy nephew of Marcel in some ways. And when he had a Serpentine Gallery show 10 or 15 years ago, I do remember writing about that, and I do remember struggling somewhat to be allowed to go on at some length about his work in a way in which now I don't think anybody would have a problem with. And is people know more than they think they do about contemporary art. As to your questions, though...
Yes.
Those three things. Elitist and irrelevant. Well, irrelevant to what? Everything's elitist, isn't it? I mean, it's a sort of... you need to know about everything, anything you're interested in. You need to know about whether you're it's contemporary art or train spotting or fishing or chess. You know, you don't expect to go to a chessboard and be able to play without knowing the rules. And even though the rules are kind of very flexible with contemporary with art in general, you've got to know how to read it a little bit. And people don't seem to understand that if that science requires discipline and a certain degree of knowledge, but they don't seem to feel the same way about contemporary art. And of course, artists, scientists aren't trying to be elitist; they're just speaking a somewhat specialised language. And more artists are speaking the vernacular of everybody else. I mean, they're taking it in directions and twisting it in ways that may seem at first unfamiliar and a bit disorientating and strange. But surely that's good. Strange is good. Disorientating is good. And so I don't think it's elitist at all. And you wander around Frieze Fair and you look at the audience here and you come from all sorts of places and all sorts of backgrounds. And you're not part of some... If you are an elite, you're a self-elected elite. Mm. And perhaps there's nothing wrong with the word elite. Elites are good in some senses. Do you want me to go through all of them? Because unskilled charlatans, that's another one.
Oh, maybe we should save a couple of them for later.
Yeah. So that's my shtick, really, to begin with.
But I was wondering, I mean, Catherine, you're one of the four of us who works outside London more than any of the rest of us. I mean, does this seem like a peculiarly kind of British discussion to be having at the beginning of this art fair in the British capital?
Tom, before I start, I have to excuse my awkward Alpine English. I'm the only only person on the panel who is not native speaker, so I hope that my speaking is understandable. I think it doesn't. I'm not so aware about the British discussion, of course, because I'm not living here. But I think this discussion is going on also on the so-called continent. I was reading in the last months often articles with similar arguments, even in very important and well-respected German newspaper, like the weekly newspaper Die Zeit, where you have very similar arguments. And at the same time, if I read this, I really think about that we are facing a similar situation like in the second half of the 19th century. You had such a discussion going on at that time as well in Europe. I would agree with Adrian that it's a very European discussion, but I would maybe say it more precisely that it's a former West European discussion. Mm. Because in East Europe, it's a different thing. In some countries of East Europe, it's a different discussion going on. But going back to the second half of the 19th century, we had 1848, we had the revolution, which affected a lot of new thinking and new perspectives. And in end of the 19th century, suddenly a kind of restorative time appeared again. And I think we have a similar situation nowadays. We had this amazing revolution in East Europe in 89, which also affected the art making in the 90s. I think there was a kind of revolutionary mood among artists and also among critics and theorists. Theory was a very important thing in the 90s. We lost this perspective of theory nowadays, for example. So I think what, and if you also look what about if you follow the art making of the very young generation, it's also dangerous what I'm saying, because you can't generalize it. There are also exceptions, but there is a kind of new historicism going on at the moment, I think.
Looking back into historicism.
Looking back into the art history and translating into nowadays. This has to do, I think, also with the confusing, fragmented times. That there is a word, I wrote it down because Habermas is using it very often, intractability. We have a kind of new intractability, which has also to do with this situation, I think, of working with art history, with the past, like you had in the second half of the 19th century. But what happened in the second half? I'm very positive. It sounds a little bit that I'm disillusionized, but I think in the second half of the 19th century, you had suddenly a discussion going on. So suddenly, if I think about Vienna, where I worked for 10 years, you had this secession movement. Mm-hmm. They really wanted to think, to develop a new thinking, to develop a new exhibition making, to develop a new perspective within art, and to think also what art means for the reality in the society. And then you had figures like Karl Kraus. Maybe you know about him. He was one of the major writers and journalists. It was Europe. He was really attacking this secessionist very much, but also Adolf Loos, the famous architect, who was very close to modernistic thinking. And I think if we would have such a discussion now, I think it would be extremely fruitful, and I would be happy if we could go deeper into such a discussion, but not only on such a panel, also in the academies, in the institutions, in all these different fields we are working with, because we have to overcome, I think, this kind of confusion, diffusion, and so on. We have to really be aware, more aware of what's going on, and also be more aware of what's going on outside or what's going on in the world. You know, we are living in an extremely fragile world, ecologically, economically, but also mentally, I think. So I think it could be a really important discussion, and I hope it's going on.
Mm. I think something that's very, very interesting in terms of some of the platitudes that we're here to discuss today is that these are advanced in part in small sections of the media, but increasingly they exist in place of the blogosphere. I don't really know what the blogosphere is, but web pages where people comment.
Absolutely. I don't blog. I mean, there are lots of bloggers around. On The Guardian, for example, I don't blog. And when I read the comments on the blogs, they're mostly terribly dispiriting and precisely those cliches about arts made by, they're all charlatans, and let's get back to real values, whatever real values may be. And
I mean, Roger, do you read this kind of material?
Well, I had to over the last couple of weeks since the Turner Prize. I sort of don't usually sort of get too involved in the sort of wider press when it comes to art writing. You tend to keep your head down. And so with the blog so much this year, the most dominant blog would be a Guardian blog, but I think because of one of the judges having to be a Guardian member, a Guardian writer, I think there's been a certain embargo, I think, on criticising or talking about the artists in particular. I think it was more about the actual
by Jonathan Jones.
Yeah. I wasn't going to mention his name.
Yeah.
But
that guy.
Yeah. And so I think he turned it around. He turned around this year to say that he was congratulating and thinking about the quality of the writing that had happened in collaboration with the Turner Prize itself.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I kind of take that. I don't know how I was reading these pieces of text and thinking that they were particularly different from a press release which had been fed to most of the people. I think there were some people that were saying this is a bit more up, this is a bit more sort of a thoughtful sort of Turner Prize this year. Last year it was kind of hell-bent on a certain sort of level of criticism, which seemed a little over-heavy.
It certainly did to me. But the pattern of clichés around that, you've got to look at the wall panels and the press releases, really.
Yes.
And they're the same always. Whatever, you just change the name, really. I mean, we're subverting the conventions and challenging people's perceptions. And when I read those, or is it subverting the perceptions and challenging the conventions? I don't know.
Well, there was a, at the end of
Gormley, you want to go.
Well, yeah. Well, at the end of Gormley's project, there was Gormley on the radio, I think, and he was saying, well, it was asking challenging and important questions. But there was no sort of offering of what those challenging and important questions could have been,
yes,
or what they were. And I think he sort of allayed it to, I think, maybe a sort of a social identity of the British people. Mm. I think that was the conclusive evidence, yeah, that he looked at for the end of that project. And I think in a way that this possibly was a red herring towards the actual structure of the artwork itself. There was a lot of apparatus involved in that piece that seemed a lot more sort of specific to actually the real piece of work, rather than just people standing on a plinth. There seemed to be a lot of sort of relay, a lot of media. And it seemed to be that sort of relaying media, the ugliness of the health and safety, you know, all of these sort of apparatus of authority seemed to sort of pour into the work. And I thought the thing that I sort of felt more sort of critical about that piece was that, yeah, it seemed to be a sort of rather wonderful sort of expression of authority and structures of authority. This, you know, using sort of CCTV, sort of weblogs, even the Radio 4 sort of authority figure of Clive Anderson, a voice of a lawyer, you know, on Sky TV. And so you had all of these sort of aspects, and you were being sort of coerced a little bit by this rather sort of hierarchical piece somehow, that the people would turn up and they would have this experience, you would watch them, but they were dislocated. And I suppose the relationship between apparatus and people tends to be in constant friction. And so this was, for me, a spectacle of constant friction between the relay of its apparatus and the people, the subjects. So, yeah, so for me, that was a kind of a meaty subject. That was kind of problematic, but I never sort of picked up on it within the writing in newspapers. But it seemed plainly obvious that the media that were relaying this information weren't part of, they were part of it, complicit within it somehow.
I must say, the words cliché and platitude, you know, as soon as I hear them, I feel kind of guilty of a crying, because I'm sure I've trotted out of plenty of both. A lot of trouble with a lot of criticism, like writing about the fair yesterday, is that you have no time, hardly time to look, and no time to write, and, well, certainly no time to reflect. And it's people want, I mean, there seems to be a hunger for the instant opinion. So is it any good or not? Mm-hmm. Who should win? And you're being pushed in this direction. One is being pushed in this direction. In the media, in about every subject one can, under the sun, really, that we can think of. But is it any good, this Berlin Biennale? I know you haven't done it yet, but will it be any good?
Sounds terrible.
But is it? Do you feel sort of coerced within the sort of structures of these? Yeah, for instance, there is a certain sort of coercion within sort of the Turner Prize in the way that the artists are sort of expected to act within the structure that's very, very set. For instance, the wall text is a very specific and problematic part of the show,
I
tried to protest against, but anyway, we won't go back.
Yeah, I think it is problematic. I do. And I've been a judge on the Turner Prize myself, so in a way, it was part of the war, but the Turner Prize seems to have done a great deal in certain respects to allay some of these criticisms that are made all the time against contemporary art. And people clearly like it. You know, people like the fair. People like the art fair. They queue up for the Turner Prize. They're interested, and I think they don't fall into. And I think they're patronised by the media rather, who feels obliged to spoon feed opinion and to be. And I'm obliged to be a kind of an explainer in a way.
Do you feel that this might be a sort of a class situation? I know that you said earlier at the beginning that it didn't seem like a class issue, but the separation of labour and the separation of craft from the actual idea of art and the identity of certain class structures being their identity to their own labour and their own endeavour, do you think that might actually add to the problems that people have with contemporary art, that there is such a divorce from the obvious expectation of actual work? Or
sure, and I think the demography of people going to art galleries has changed. I mean, there may have been a sense, you know, if you read Charivari in the late 19th century and people going to the Salon and everything, and people did go to gawp, and I'm sure there is still a degree of that, and there was quite a lot of gawping going on last night, drunken gawping. here, but I think it isn't necessarily. I think it's less class based. Gallery going is less class based than it once perhaps was, and that's a good thing, obviously. And people are more intelligent than they give, and have a more vital curiosity and imagination than they're often given credit for.
I suppose in a way, I'm not wanting to pick on Gormley at all, but in a way with that piece too, there was a suggestion of an egalitarian kind of position that anybody could turn up and have this sort of art moment. They were complicit within the art. But
and not just that, but also a kind of carefully managed egalitarianism as well.
Yeah, exactly.
People were drawn from different parts of the country, so there was a kind of texture to who was on the plinth.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they were very much vetted, and there was a lot of preemptive information that was given out on the arches on Radio 4 about this piece. And so there was a lot of what you expect, a lot of self-policing, a lot of sort of, we want you to feel that you should be a bit more middle class and behave. This is an experience which is wonderful. You should actually feel very privileged. The word privilege came up. They invented a new word for them, plinthers. And so it seemed all this sort of ridiculous sort of structure sort of laid onto a piece seemed to be this rather shrill kind of way of actually just keeping this piece in check and making sure that this kind of social object that was in the present, you know, within the world was actually kept in control. And so there were all these very, very strange and rather depressing sort of levels of control on this piece. And so for me, that's what I take from that piece. It's just,
and we had the director of the National Portrait Gallery saying, plinth is good, and he even went on the plinth himself, standing there, and the director of the National Gallery saying, plinth is very bad, and it makes all the hoi polloi, kind of, he'd be more hoi and more polloi, or whatever it is they do. So it brought up lots of class issues, really. I was surprised there was less sort of transgressive behaviour, really, all in all. So I think you're right about the self-policing.
But also as well as that, I guess it made sense outside the National Portrait Gallery, I guess as part of our cerebral cortex, which is far more developed to actually recognise the portraiture of people. That's why there is a portrait gallery, it's because we want to go and see people, because we're more efficiently sort of wanting to read people's faces, and so that museum. So in a way, there was a sort of an interesting linkage, perhaps, between that piece and the Natural Portrait Gallery itself, but that didn't seem to be sort of exploited in the most obvious and most interesting way, that this is a public portrait somehow.
But I think it will. I think it won't the archive end up at the National Portrait Gallery? I thought that was part
I
of the...
I think that is part of the deal.
Part of the idea, yeah.
And I'm sure there'll be a rather glossy kind of album soon of all of the plinthers.
Indeed. Did news of the plinth reach your alpine fastness?
Not really. I heard about this piece, but I'm not aware about these discussions. I think it's very interesting to listen to you. It's for me a completely new information I'm receiving here.
Mm. We found a new way of controlling people, basically. Like, we developed very good ways of social control. But
Not at all, Roger.
We've just had lots of problems with social control over the last sort of 6 months or so, and so it just seemed that this was a continuation of that. You know, the City of London in this piece seemed to have a certain sort of relationship which seemed to behave in very similar ways, but one was a middle-class version and the other one was trying to be a sort of a more sort of globalised idea about sort of how we're supposed to behave.
I suppose one of the reasons that Anthony Gormley comes up in this discussion, bless him, is because he makes quite a lot of noise about how egalitarian his work is and about how and some works deal specifically being about us and there is a certain utopian and charming aspect to his work as well as a degree of pomposity sometimes. But he is also equally accused by a current serving Turner Prize jury member, not unconnected to the Guardian newspaper, of being a sort of latter-day Arno Becker, a sort of proto-fascist in some way, which seems absurd to me. But anyway, but in a way, a lot of the criticisms that you're talking about here in your questions are ones that his work has, in some sense, addressed, even by using the unskilled to help him make works like Field. So,
I mean, I was kind of interested in something that Roger was saying, a kind of connection between sort of a lack of making with a particular kind of section of the population that makes. But given how many people now work in the service industry rather than any kind of manufacturing or any kind of craft, I mean, do you still think this is true? Do you simply think there's a kind of rupture within kind of arts address?
Well, when I was a postman, which was the service industry, I sort of...
Postman?
I was a bloody postman. And so, yeah, I did go on strike once as well. But it was a long time ago. But I was a postman in Peckham. And I was very much interested in the idea that you were part of a service industry, that you were basically just I'd come through university. And it was and Goldsmiths at the time was quite an experimental place. And I think you probably remember that too.
I do, yes. You experimented on coming to tutorials once or twice, I remember.
You know, I was a teenager, I had better things to do. But it was
dabbled in tutorials.
Dabbled in tutorials, yes. Those are the days.
Never inhaled.
But there was a certain feeling that you were sort of part of a very open sort of experiment, but production wasn't part of it. You know, you weren't sort of part of a place where you felt studio bound, that production and result wasn't something that you actually had to reveal at any point in time. You did have conveners. You had these things where you had to sort of display work, but you could actually just talk your way through it, or you could just wing it. And so that was a sort of a good lesson in some respect of what is actually really sort of the future, or the future that we're now in the present of, which is this feeling of a crisis within the idea of production and actually making artworks, about how you're supposed to actually apply the actual sort of knowledge and technique to the actual physical manifestation of an artwork itself. And so I think I might be going completely off the...
That's okay. What you're talking about is this thing about made by unskilled skeletons, and the word skill is the key, isn't it?
Well, skill is key, and also...
And it's another meaning of art. Art is skill.
Always a very reactive sort of place with craft. When I, you know, about 10 years ago, there was this real sort of talk about re-emergence of craft, and I think that sort of argument does sort of re-emerge sort of every 10 years or so, and I think we're probably going through another one. And that sort of happens because people want to actually feel more comforted by the idea that there are people being endeavoured and just wanting to sort of make things. And there is a certain sort of primal sort of comfort and that we're predisposed to make objects because we've made objects of conflict since we were cavemen. And so in a way, this is... Yeah, the continuation of that. I don't know how long I can wing this one for.
Does anyone actually think that? I mean, skill is satisfying too, isn't it? And to look at and to acquire for oneself. So skill is a good thing.
But skill is a stasis. Skill offers a stasis as well. That that once you've learned something, you have a practice which is actually learned. And it can only be perfected. And in its perfection, it's keeping you in the same place. And so my suspicion of painting was always sort of a part of that, was the fact that you couldn't move. And that it doesn't seem a reflection of basically the society or the ways that we live in keeping the same or trying to be consistent, whereas I see society actually being more inconsistent, of people endeavouring to be inconsistent. And so for me personally, I'm going to move on from the things that I do right now, and I have a plan for the future, but only I know what that plan is. And so there is this sort of interesting sort of relationship to not having a skill. And as soon as you recognise a skill, then you should just drop it and move on. That's for me the.
I think you're saying something very important. I think also regarding the academies, you know, we have, you said also the crisis of production, you know, and I think this is also something which would fill a panel to talk about overproduction, what we had, and crisis of production, and why it's leaded to such a situation. And I think skilled and unskilled is also connected to professionalization of our art world system. The academies became extremely professionalized. They became more or less institutions, you know. And if I'm sometimes talking with younger artists born end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s already, they really learn how to sell their ideas, how to talk about their works. They're very extremely skilled. It's a completely difference to 10 years ago. Yeah.
Mm. And so the media skill.
The media skill, yes. Yeah. And I think it's the role of the academies is also very interesting, or the changement and transformation of the academies in the last years is also super interesting. On the continent, you have the so-called Bologna process. You know, they took all. It's a kind of European Union idea that it's a kind of complex thing that the academies more or less are more universities than they were academies, mm-hmm. that they're more professionalized, that you can have a PhD, which was not possible in the old academies. I think there are many good things connected with it, but on the other hand, they gave up also a lot of autonomy, a lot of experimental flexibility and all these things. So this is also, I think, what could be interesting to think about.
I think you're absolutely right, and having been both a student at a British art school and taught in British and European art schools, they all seem to be becoming homogenous and less vital places.
Yes.
And perhaps I'm looking back with certainly sort of rose-tinted eyes, but glasses. But
and there's also no time anymore. You know, they are like machineries. You have to make one exam after the other. I'm more now. I don't know how it's in England, but I think it's necessary again to have time. You know, not to finish the academy within 4 years. So if you want to study 10 years, you should have the possibility to do it, because maybe you wanna be in this protected place for 10 years and test and out something
like
and discuss some.
Yes, like a kind of monastery.
More or less.
And in addition to that, as well, is that I think maybe in this country, perhaps since the sort of the introduction that students would have to actually sort of pay their own way within the studio, the art school situation, that there has been a sort of impetus on the idea of result, that perhaps that these students have to come out with a set of values and a set of results which have been instilled in them, simply because it's what's seen as a responsible way of teaching, because they've given the money, they need to see a result at the end of it. Whereas at Goldsmiths, when and Adrian was there, and when I was sort of studying there, there was this rather laissez-faire way of working. You just turned up, and you didn't know particularly why you were there. You would just amble around and make sort of social connections with your other peers in the university, and then you would drink pretty much most of the time. And it was a really sort of great place, because it just was a reflection of the real world, the outside world, is that basically you're not expecting anything. You're just basically being, and you're just having this experience.
Except that you have a sort of great safety net too, and there are people, you're with like-minded people, and you can have a serious discussion about art or whatever, you know.
But you're encouraged to. But also, but I think the use of critical theory within sort of the art school now is almost like a time and measure sort of usage, that you could actually sort of meter out information, criticism, because you know at the end of the day you're trying to design a group of individuals to be self-critiquing or have an idea about sort of the levels of critique that they're supposed to apply, and give them the right tools of what that critique should be, and that will homogenize things.
It will, and you get a European standard art school with European standard artists coming out of it, and instead of having a vital inner imaginative life and an interesting discourse, people come out with platitudes come and go in two directions. It's not just the things that are leveled against art, but things
but
that artists
what
say.
Happened with the academies, it's the same with museums and other art institutions, that they take over the ecological patterns and ideologies. So what you have in on the continent, you have every year a Rundgang, and it's kind of a big show the academies are doing for the public. They're announcing it in the art magazines and like institutions also, and it forces also the students to produce. You know, they have, and they're eager, of course. If you talk with the teachers, they would love to. They're loving to produce. But I think it's a pity that we, in our field, also in the institutions, I suffered when I was running an institution, that we are following these patterns and not to redefine the position of institutions and define our own structures, you know, and are more closer to artists, so that artists are not servants of our ideas and of our programs and so on. So that I think this is also something which happened in the last years, in this enormous changement we were going through.
There's a sort of collision, isn't there, between this this cliched public perception that the best art is made by starving people in garrets who aren't corrupted by the system. And from the other side, this idea that that in a way people went through art school before the economic crash because they knew they could have a good career in the art world and that you could be a career artist. And in fact, we all know of career artists, really, whose works go around the monopoly board of the art world and challenge nothing, really. But so the clichés seem to meet in the middle somewhere. Mm-hmm. And do you think it's a healthier situation since it's all...
Too early to tell.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I think there were models of working that we've seen. I'm using that expression, which is a horrible expression. But there are ways of working that we were very present at how they were working. You know, the market has been incredibly prominent within the last maybe 10 years of art making. And so artists, a certain group of artists, have shifted towards supplying that need. And so the work itself then became a reflection of the actual collector rather than the artist. So you did have these kind of ideas of sort of new ageism, sort of like agnosticism. You know, these sort of rather sort
agnosticism.
Of...
Agnosticism.
But you would have all these sort of rather sort of wobbly ideas about sort of how to live. And they would be injected within the sort of ethos of the work, and that reflected... The crisis of the collector rather than the actual artist.
Yes, like this idea that rich people in Malibu buy Bill Viola because Bill Viola makes you feel better about being a money-grubbing bastard in the real world. And you can go all spiritual in your private life and you've got a Bill Viola there.
Well, no, completely true. And so, the real world or the reality of anything is that there are certain sort of issues that we should engage with. We're becoming a far more secular society, and how do we create an art form that actually represents that sort of feeling or that sort of that ambition that religion or sort of the metaphorical might be sort of disappearing, and that maybe I'm not saying that there's going to be convergence with sciences, perhaps, but there is a certain sort of way that sort of art should sort of interact with the actual realities of what it is that we're actually having to deal with in the next period. And
I think it's the only way how to make a future thinkable again. Mm-hmm. You know, at the moment, I have sometimes the impression that the future is not thinkable anymore. But not only in the art fields; it's the same in the politics and in other fields of our world. But I think this could be one thing to do. You know,
We have to shrug off the clichés that we've gathered over so long, and also the way that writing, that the work has been sort of. You know, I talk to people all the time. I had somebody in the studio the day, and he was talking about the crisis of criticism, and it's just like, I had no answer for that, really. You know, I don't know
but that has all, the crisis of criticism has evolved its own vocabulary, so you can kind of tinker around within that without actually ever saying anything new.
You can enjoy it as well. You can enjoy that crisis rather like, I don't know.
I just stagger from one deadline to the next, really, but that's my crisis. It happens at the desk. It's rather than the bigger picture. But will your Biennale, because you're doing the next Berlin Biennale, are you going to be addressing any of these issues?
I have to, you know. If you're living in such a world, you can't withdraw in your in your inner world. I think you have to be aware of what's going on around us. And I think the question of arts and reality, if you say it in this simple way, is again very, very interesting. I think what is specifically in the former Western world, what is our connection to the world, which is so fragile at the moment and has obviously no future if you read articles and watch TV. So I think it's important to rethink. It's a very old thinking. Of course, you had it in the 19th century, the 20th century, very often, but always connected to crisis. You know, if you think about the 60s, it was an issue at the 60s. It was also a time of crisis. The same after 1848. This was same discussion was going on. I think we have to pose these questions again.
We're talking in pessimistic terms, but I'm actually really sort of excited
about
the next sort of period, because there is a lot of work which is actually of relevance now, that we've actually sort of scraped back the blanket, the comfort blanket that money allows.
Yes.
And so once the blanket is gone, it sort of seeps back in. I think there's an actual interesting world that actually has to be sort of has to be explored. Mm.
And there can be also a new political point of view, you know, because I think the political point of view in the arts, also if you look back in the 90s, doesn't work anymore. So many models are not working anymore, but I think we could have a new kind of political point of view also within arts, which we need. Yeah. It would has to be a different one, you know. I also don't have now an answer to it, but I think it's something we have to work on, you know. I think many models, if you look what happened in the 90s, also many political movements and had also kind of La Polar situation. You know, it didn't open up something. It didn't open new perspectives. This is also something which is very interesting. I'm involved in a research project called Former West, which is organized in Holland, in Van Abbe Museum in Bach in Utrecht. For me, it's very interesting because I started in the 90s to work in this field, to look what happened in the 90s, how did the art develop in the 90s, and what does it mean for nowadays? So we start with 89, with the fall of the Berlin Wall. Then we look until 2001, because this is kind of periods. And then from 2001 to 2008, where we had the so-called financial crisis. And then until nowadays, in order to understand, in order to also to develop a kind of new perspective, for us, working with artists and making exhibitions possible, but maybe it's also gives also new perspectives for the art world, you know. Mm-hmm. And this, no one did this kind of reflection in such a way. So there are different scientists involved, so not only people from the art world. Mm-hmm. So just in order to pose new questions and maybe also to start developing also answers, maybe, hopefully. But we have to pose questions, I think. We are in a situation, as you said, it's too early to say something. And I think our situation at the moment is posing questions.
But not wanting to apply art as a research idea, but there is a certain feeling, or there's a certain desire within me. It's not my whole desire to make artworks, but there is a certain sort of need to feel that it is a certain sort of point of view as a research.
Yes.
That the serialization and the idea of multiples within the sort of the market of feeding a market idea of making artworks is a form of stasis, and a lack of curiosity about your own production, about the way that you make your own work. And so, you know, I never ascribed to or particularly cared for that way of working, and so it was always sort of interesting to then see what the other options were, and then you would apply the idea of research, because simply you're just making a prototype artwork, you're just making a possibility, and then you're moving on from that possibility, because you're not wanting to flog it a million times, you're just wanting to see what the reaction, the sort of the social kind of construct that you've just put out there, and you just want to see sort of its reaction, and so and then you move on, and then you sort of try other things, because it is a sort of an open research, and that we can apply the sort of the terms of our own research by the terms of our own stimulus somehow.
Do you think this will lead somewhat inevitably to a situation where art, you know, there was always a measure of an artist's worth is whether or not they could live off their art. And in a way, if you're not making things that you can flog, how can you live off your art?
Well, there's always an idea of heritage artist, I think, that sort of has a certain sort of idea about what art is when they leave college. They're slightly bohemian, and they sort of want to just kind of live in the garret, and they want to live that sort of rather stylized
fancy garret.
Sort of fancy garret, because it's never a real garret. Yeah. No, exactly, because the parents usually bail them out. And so it's kind of You have this. Sorry, that was a horrible thing to say. But it sounds a bit angry. Mine didn't bail me out. But it's sort of that you have this sort of way of working, which is a rather old-fashioned sort of notion, and it comes with the platitude, the cliche of what an artist actually technically is.
You're doing so useful work, useful production, rather than a service industry.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, because it has become a service industry, of course. And then you know, and then Frieze, is this a service industry for the City of London? Is the City of London basically is the rest of London a service and lodgings for the City of London was a concept.
Now, the City of London is a service industry for Frieze. It's the other way around.
Oh, right, okay. Well, yeah, there's always confusion about that.
Upside down.
I mean, I think before we go to questions with the audience, one last thing I'd like to ask you is these platitudes which are identified by Jorg and Jennifer and Dan, I mean, are there ones you feel that are in circulation that are more pernicious, more difficult, that come either at us, what we do, artists, curators, critics, or come from us out into the wider world? do you want a quick reminder?
I do need the quick reminder. I don't know. I don't recognise my life within these questions. You know, I think it's a populist kind of idea about what artists are, and I tend to keep my head down. So I don't usually get worried about these. Sorry, Tom.
That's okay.
There is also the cliche that, you know, I'm on some panel in a few weeks in Oxford about whether conceptual art is no art at all, which is another of the cliches around, and which is
fantastic.
It's like a nothing question, isn't it? A nothing argument. Really. Oh, there are all sorts of cliches. Like the cliche that art ought to be good for you is one, I think.
Well, I know where that came from.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know where it's going, but it's an unending war, really. But I think the question of crisis is interesting, because that's a sort of crisis and the end we also feel are somehow clichés. But a sense of crisis and a sense of things ending is perennial, as Frank Kermode pointed out in a wonderful book about 30 or 40 years ago. They're actually very enervating, and they're ever. It's a nice meaty subject, the end and the crisis, yes. And it gives artists something to do rather than just making knickknacks for rich people.
I would confirm what you're saying. I think the crisis is the interesting thing, and it's not only the economical crisis, because I don't know what it is. It's anyhow the system is repaired, it's working again in the way it worked. It will. I think the collapse will come very soon, but not tomorrow. Maybe in a few years. But at the moment, it's no discussion. But I think also the mental crisis is an interesting thing. So I'm not. For me, also these questions, they're very conservative. Mm-hmm. So maybe even neoliberal. So I don't care. I don't feel connected to such. But also, cliches.
But we should also say that crisis is a positive situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the crisis is not a negative word. You know, the Victorian idea of what this crisis was orgasm.
Yeah. But I did an exhibition in 2001, you know, and I thought at that time I was very much working with artists from Middle East European region, and I thought at that time maybe we have to give up the idea of positive thinking, because until that time it was still the thing, you know, and to think about disillusionment, but without saying this is the end, just as a new power of a new perspective. And I think the crisis can be the same thing. It can be super interesting to develop and to think about.
But should we be careful to who to listen to? Because obviously there's a lot of information, there's a lot of writing out there within the more academic sort of journals and on the internet, and there is a certain sort of push and pull of what sort of agendas should be set, and a lot of them tend to come from a sort of critical theory based sort of situation where which seem to be actually rather delving philosophical as well, delving into sort of again sort of structures of authority within the new system perhaps, and people are, I guess it's kind of a fetish kind of subject somehow. People really enjoy talking about how to control people, but
and it's also becoming a cliche. It has also this danger. It's just kind of superficial, fancy topic.
Yeah, it sounds masculine. Yeah. It sounds meaty, yeah.
Sexy, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, like a disaster movie.
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so we'll end on eschatology and now go to questions. Does anyone have any questions? We got a mic or something. somewhere we can bring to these people. Brilliant. So the gentleman over there.
Cliché. This market is dangerously based on tick. How true is that?
Tick, get the product now, pay later.
Get the product and pay later.
Is that what you meant by tick, sir, yeah?
No idea, personally.
Me too, I don't
haven't a clue.
I think Roger's probably the only one who deals with that directly, and maybe you don't want to say. So.
I hardly said anything, so. I don't know. If you can't afford it, don't buy it.
Yeah, I think what the gentleman was saying, yeah, sometimes collectors will acquire a work very early and not pay for several years, and that's, I think we could all agree that that's problematic.
Yeah. Bad people. Pay now.
Oh, yeah, it's true, that happens a lot.
Money up front.
That's a bad thing.
And so we had another question here, this lady here. Can we bring the microphone, please? Thank you.
I suppose there's a kind of contradiction, really, having that kind of discussion here, where we're talking about what, you know, the really important things about making artwork and the kind of questions and pushing boundaries, but we're sitting within a marketplace, I suppose. And, you know, I suppose that's where that kind of question might have come from before. And I sort of immediately thought, well, how does it all sit with where we are here at Frieze? The other thing is, and I really loved what Roger was saying, and they're kind of, you know, presenting artwork as possibilities. But how does that, and sort of thinking about, you know, that wonderful thing, but then how does it get a platform? How does it get out there? How does it, and then you kind of sit within this, you know, kind of public space. I suppose what, you know, the way into these things is usually through a gallery. You know, I know people work together to make things happen, and but anyway, I don't know if there's a question in there.
The relationship with the curator is always one which is actually quite prominent these days. I used to say that the curator exists so the artist doesn't have to speak, and there was a sort of a feeling for a long while that they did take on the agenda of an artist, but they also took on their own sort of specific agendas. There's never a sort of purity in that relationship. But as the artist's sort of voice, perhaps within the relationships of curators and working, becomes stronger, and there's more identity where the artist's work is actually about, you know, not specificity, I can't even pronounce that word, sorry, I won't even try again, being specific, is that that you don't, that your work actually extols its own sort of kind of information, and that the curator is a pretty viable sort of way of expressing the work. And I think with the dealer, it can be a bit more commercial than that. You know, the relationship is more commercial. And I'm sure that dealers prefer the idea of being a curator dealer for their own artists, because no one knows an artist better than the dealer that represents
them. That's when they're gallerists and not dealers.
Gallerists and dealers,
that's the idea,
it's terrible, isn't it? I see the word dealer now. The word gallerist seems to have disappeared into the ether somehow. Yeah. But my dealer doesn't mind.
But about talking here, I mean, one of the cliches of the moment is that you know, art fairs are the new biennales. But why not here? You know, it's where people who are interested in art gather, so this seems a perfectly good place.
And maybe Gustav, will you hear me? Maybe Gustav Metzke is right. He said we have to oppose the system, but not in that we are not. But at the same time, we have to take part, you know, in order to change the cultural situation. So opposing doesn't mean not to participate. I think we have to incorporate also these voices in the different sections of the art world. Mm-hmm. And I think he's very contemporary with this idea. Still, it's an idea of the 60s, most probably.
Or even Trotsky, really. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But
or even, you know, a sort of Mandel or you know, this idea, you know, of repressive tolerance and so on. But you know, that by incorporating dissent, and it shows you how it reflects your own liberalism or something, that you're a good person or something, but at the same time stifling it, which is a bit too Marxist, really, isn't it, for this time of the afternoon?
Anyway. This lady here, please.
Yeah. I know it's kind of a cliche, but artists who don't think about the market at all, I'm making a documentary about art brute, and so outsider art. And so I'm just was curious about if you could say something about, you mentioned the word purity. Do we still talk about that anymore?
There's a relationship between the idea and the making and holding yourself as an artist without the idea of influence from the outside, that you don't carry people into the studio with you. You don't carry the collector, the dealer. You don't carry critics or writers or context. You just want to just have the rather binary relationship with what it is that you're actually trying to achieve, with the physicality of the making of the work, perhaps, or the object itself eventually. And so, yeah, there is a certain idea of purity within that, because in a way you're trying to shed influence, you're trying to shed coercion from the outside world within that structure. And yeah, I suppose you could use that. Maybe purity is too pure a word, perhaps, but it's sort of it's a useful word to consider when you're surrounded by, basically, you could spend all your time within the art world. You could sort of hide within it and make it your home, and then you would never really get anything of any real use done somehow. It's a sustaining support system somehow for a lot of people. And so it's kind of good to sort of remain detached from that. As an artist, I feel that the art world is just simply something else, somewhere else. It's another mechanism. And basically that I just have this stay-at-home thought. I quite like hanging out at home. It sounded really weedy, but
you can hang out with your baby now.
Well, yeah, I've just had a baby.
Exactly.
And that's a really nice thing to do, actually, I have to say.
Do we have any more questions for the panel? This lady here, please.
Hi. One of the things I've experienced in the last sort of 10 years in the art world and sort of since leaving art school is this massive sort of cross-disciplinary artists, curators, gallerists, everybody's doing each other's jobs, and not just within the art world but also within industry. And, you've got artists working for different kinds of companies, and whenever I've gone for a job, being an artist has been a positive thing. And I just wanted to know how that fed through to you. Has it made it more accessible? Because we were talking about accessibility and whether it's irrelevant, and does that make art more relevant because people want artists in their industries?
I would also, in this case, I would also argue with purity, because I think it would be good, again, to really to stay in the profession you are, to be a curator and not to be at the same time a dealer and a gallerist, and to be a gallerist. And it would make, and with the artists, I'm more generous. I think artists can they are excellent curators very often also. And I saw very important shows created by artists. So I think the artists have a different situation within this system, but for curators, gallerists, museum directors, I would really think it would be very helpful for our situation at the moment if they would stay with their profession and not have this unclarity. And I think it's also it's also dangerous because you're losing also a voice if you move it within these different circles. You're not you're not honest really anymore if you jump from one place to the other. So
and I think particularly working as a curator or critic and as a dealer, you've almost kind of sported yourself forever.
I mean, I've been criticised for curating shows as well as
really
as well as being a critic, yes.
And for the Haywood show?
For the Haywood, for... I can't remember the last one, really. Where was it? Sir Alves Museum in Porto. And, I do it about once every 7 or 8 years, really, when someone invites me. And I love curating shows, but it's not my profession. Perhaps I should say selecting shows, but better. But I like it in old-fashioned way. But I love installing as well. But I think we do what we want, really. I think we should be free to do what we want. We might not be very good at it if we try. As George Eliot said, genius is doing one thing in particular well, not a million, things in general. And we find out through life tells us what we're good at and what we're not good at. But I think we should be free, really. But I do disapprove of curators who also advise. I disapprove. I never say people should or shouldn't do anything, but the critic who advises the private collector or you know, I think is in a dodgy situation. And yes, I think there are lines that one tries not to cross, mm-hmm. partly because you meet such awful people when you do.
And we had one question from somebody at the back there. Have the mic, and then I've probably got time for one or two quick more.
Can you hear my voice all right, or is it too loud? Is that all right? Okay, yeah. I wanted to touch upon you've all said very interesting things that I wanted to somehow bring together and pose two questions which are different. Adrian Searle started talking about basically the popularization and populism in art, and gave us examples. David Hockney, who was the adopted boy artist, the sort of person everyone felt comfortable with, and it's a peculiarly English thing. And also how Tracy Emin and Grayson Perry figure on the cover of The Guardian, whatever it is, too. And the difficulty of having European or foreign art accepted in the same way. And you've also talked, so on the one hand, art becoming something that we're comfortable with, so you diffuse it to the greatest possible number, but does it then change very fundamentally? And should we have a more elitist, or leave room for elitism? Because Roger also talked about the time of experimentation, and as the lady from Berlin, Katrin, is it? Yes, talked about uncertainty, and we live in a time of uncertainty, and art should also accommodate that. But how, and maybe Adrian, who is, let's say, a mediator and helps to, I won't even say popularise art, but act as a channel and as someone who alerts people, because it is a very important role that that you have in order for a lot of people to hear about things that they wouldn't normally hear about. I say this also because although I'm a Londoner, I've been living in Italy and coming back to London, and one of the things that I find wonderful here, just the fact that Frieze exists, which is an elitist sort of platform, but that you can have things which touch a lot of lives, and that a lot of people in London will know the taxi driver or, you know, a sort of teenager who doesn't go to exhibitions will happen to know it's on. That comes from people like Adrian and others writing about it. I don't want to lose sight of my thing.
Yeah, to summarise, I mean, question is...
The elite, should we have, yes, should we have some kind of elitist situation where people are not producing art to sell? You talked about a situation in art colleges, the lady in Germany, but also... Because
I think if you just ditch the word should, everything's... Because we do have all... you know, Katrin said about fragmentation, we have all these things as it is. And we have both the very popular, you know, the idea of the artist as a kind of social character, you know, whether it was Hockney then or Tracy now. We have that. And Salvador Dali, I suppose, was a sort of showman, you know, lots of examples. But we also have artists who prefer to remain relatively anonymous and just get on with their work, you know. And you don't have to be a kind of media star at all, as Roger will confirm. Although he would be, you know, he's perfectly handsome and would look great on TV, hugely articulate, and, you know, all the rest of it. But you don't have to play that game. But the thing is that, in a way, the newspapers and the media love people who do play that game, so you end up... The whole thing eats its own tail, really. But.
I just agree with Adrian. It just becomes a content provision somehow, that the artists themselves... you know, there was a really curious moment when I think... I'm going to start naming names.
Go on.
No, I can't start naming names. It's really unfair. But
could you mime it? Mime the name.
You know, <that'd be> a specific artist who's got a show at the Wallace at the moment was
Damien Hirst.
was actually talking about... the paintings in a radio program before the paintings have actually been finished, or that a lot of them hadn't been sort of produced yet. And I think in a way that you are sort of maybe lacking a certain priority if you just call up the newspaper to say that you're working on a painting. before you've made the painting. And so there's this kind of feeling of that was how it used to be, and that's how it is still to some degree. And also there's a sort of caricature artist that artists can suddenly sort of select a certain sort of cultural aspiration, talk about sort of, you know, I represent the idea of a traditional British identity. There's one artist in the fair today who wears dresses that sort of talks about it, his work in that way. And so it's he's taken a very specific role, and it's almost like a role is up for grabs and you can just take it, and then you can sit quite happily just sort of making sure that this is your role, and then you'll defend it.
And you could be the curmudgeonly critic, you know, like Brian Sewell or something, who, you know, who I don't mind in all sorts of ways, but at all. But and you can be what's this cliche curator? I suppose there was a time when it had to be an Italian man with a bouffant. what was his name? Forget him. But
I don't know. You know, I have no idea because I never studied curating, so I'm not. I don't have a clear cliche, but curating also only came up it's a very young profession, in fact. It's. I also think that artist who is connected to the art market, it's as fine as an artist who refuses being part of the system. I wouldn't say this is the more interesting position than the other.
This is not the central criteria for judgment.
This is no criteria. It's the artwork is the criteria, not the connection of the artist to the different systems. So I
absolutely agree.
And I think we have opportunity for two more quick questions. So hand up there, please.
A bit of nervousness about the practice of painting, and because it can define certain things immediately, because we are very adept at reading something quickly. Mm. It's quite a scary practice. But do you see it included in the contemporary art scene, or are you ruling it out because it's not fast enough?
Well, painting.
Yeah, do you see room for beautiful things that develop and they are slow?
The fair is full of paintings, isn't it?
Pardon?
The art fair is full of paintings.
It is. I'm asking you.
Oh, it's me?
Ahead. Yeah, ahead of the next. So looking ahead.
Because I made a comment about painting. Well, there's two reasons. I thought that painting under ideology is really interesting and perfect and interesting. You know, I think supremacism and all that. So, you know, they're really wonderful kind of cultural sort of positions to take. I can't see how painting has an ideology or a specific reason to this is terrible to say, but I don't see it as a specific reason to exist. It's going to make a lot of people hate me. But the reason why I say this is that it's a bit more psychological than that, because my brother is a painter, and so so it all comes clear now. But and so we had this rather push and pull relationship about how to justify our own means. I was like, my brother just couldn't understand me, still doesn't, and vice versa. So I went to Goldsmiths, he went to Slade. And we had this at the same time as well. And so we had this sort of very strange kind of relationship. And so I think, in a way, my destructive tendencies towards the ideas of painting tended to come from the fact that I just thought it just lacked a sense of identity. That you do see painters, you do see some prominent painters, you see sort of like, I enjoy painters like Luke Toymans. But then I see a whole raft of artists, perhaps, sort of mimicking, perhaps. And then for me, then that seems to suggest a crisis or a particularly bad crisis of how to actually perform as an artist or how to perform as a painter, because that was the market.
That's not to do with a crisis. That's to do with mediocrity. So you've got, for every Luke Toymans or Malena Dumas, you've got the wannabe Lukeys and the wannabe Malenas. You know, art schools are full of them, and art fairs too. And I'd say that, you know, you're... In a way, your atomized airplane engine at the Tate is almost a painting by other means, really, and you're kind of stepping into it backward.
No, that's not quite true.
Just a bit.
Anything more on painting?
Rather not.
So we have one.
Just don't do it.
That's what we're all saying. Just don't do it.
Yes.
Do you mean we as a species or we painters?
Yes.
And it could be you need some people
But they do, they're given one. They, I mean, well, there's no problem of painting being ignored. Painting is... Well, there they are, you know.
I could just add to that I do appreciate painting for being a very extreme sort of process, an extreme way of working. You're contemplating a rectangle or square, and there is something really strangely sort of alienating about that whole process. The temperament of painters tends to be very different to the temperament of a lot of other people that I know, and I'm being a bit general about that, but it tends to be a very psychological struggle, and for that I really admire it. I think it's very interesting. But I think that there are certain strategies that are opposed, that are applied to painting, which I think are red herrings, perhaps. And I see a lot of it. I see a lot of red herrings applied to painting, and there's no essential sort of necessary... You know, I think there are some painters I do like.
I think we need to make way for John Baldessari soon. So, if we have one more quick question, but if it's a really long one, maybe
Big John, before Big John strides in...
Oh, that would be such a horrible way to end. One more question.
One more question, anybody? Or are we done? Okay, looks like we're done. Thank you very much to the panel.
Thank you.